Hello, and welcome to the 29th episode of Wildfire Matters, the podcast that covers all aspects of wildland fire management for the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. We talk with the people who help manage and protect our public lands, many who dedicate their lives to the profession. And I just want to point out, when we talk about BLM fire, we are also including the aviation program. So it's BLM fire and aviation, but just to make it easy for people, it's BLM fire, all-encompassing. And today we are happy to have, or I am happy to have, Piper is actually on a fire assignment, so I'm going solo today with Matt Dutton from the National Aviation UAS Program Manager for the BLM, the Remote Pilots and Remote Systems Program Manager. That's kind of a
mouthful.
Yeah, so welcome.
Thank you, Matt. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, so first off, just tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started, and how you ended up as the UAS program manager. And I guess I should say UAS stands for Unmanned or Uncrewed Aircraft Systems, depending on what agency you work for.
Right, yep.
So we'll probably talk about that a little bit later, too.
Sure. Yeah. I can say that never in my wildest imagination did I think I would work in the BLM National Aviation Office or in the UAS field. Started probably similar to most folks, operationally oriented, started in 1994 over in LeGrand, not too far from here, and just kind of followed the pretty standard operational path. You know, it's been mid-90s as a hotshot with the Forest Service and then transitioned to the Park Service and spent the majority of my career with the Park Service, kind of on that fire use, backcountry, wildland fire management type world, which I loved and thrived in and miss. And then when I moved to Boise in 2014, just, you know, kind of some one thing after another fell into place. I started working in the training center with Kelly Woods, and that was about the time that the BLM stood up their UAS program, and they were looking for some training coordination, some training support, and Gil Dustin, my predecessor, came over and had a conversation with Kelly, and fortunately for me, my name was forwarded, and I helped them out. And so from 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20, I was the UAS training specialist for the program, for the BLM, and then that morphed and evolved into me landing into this job when Mr. Gil Dustin retired.
And he left a couple years ago.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the program's been around since about 2015, correct?
Well, the program, ironically, has been around since 2010.
Oh.
The earliest, you know, trainings and cartings and operations go back to 2010. I kind of just refer to it as this kind of contemporary era. Our modern era ramp up started in 2015.
We really started taking it seriously and looking at how it can benefit fire and all our resource programs.
Yeah, and to put a number to it, I mean, in 2015, 16, 17, we trained like 187 Bureau remote pilots and had about that many aircraft in the Bureau doing various work across all the program areas.
Wow. So explain the remote pilots and remote systems program. Like, what is it?
Yeah. You know, I've been around long enough to try not to get caught up in alphabet soup, and I could see some of the writing on the wall with the politics that were going on at the time with the secretary order and executive orders. And, you know, is it unmanned? Is it uncrewed? You know, the Forest Service still uses unmanned. The DOI switched to uncrewed. Colleges and academia seem to have landed on unoccupied. And I'm just like, man, I feel like we might play this game for the rest of my career. And I would rather put the focus on what it is, and that's remote pilots and remote systems aircraft. And I just wanted to call that out. It gets us away from the alphabet soup and whatever's going to happen there. But it puts the emphasis on what it is that we do, which is we train people to become remote pilots and go out and do good work with remote systems aircraft, and just wanted to call it what it is.
So what type of training is required to become a remote systems remote pilot?
Yeah. So a remote pilot in the BLM is pretty robust. You know, we have a lot of lessons and a lot of time doing this. We're close to 10 years of working through this program. And every day and every week and every month and every year, we learn so much, and that asks us to evolve and adapt our training curriculum and how we deliver. And we really put a lot of energy in the performance and experiential learning aspects of our training. So our the Bureau training is pretty robust. And so all Department of Interior remote pilots are required to have the FAA Part 107 certificate. That's something that you get through the FAA. And that's kind of the entry card into any DOI UAS training. And so the DOI minimum per the Office of Aviation Services, OAS, is the basic A450, what we call basic remote pilot. And that's a one-week course. And that's a great class. It has all of the important knowledge topics, you know, airspace management, policy, safety, risk management, all those things are folded into that class. But that's a lot to fold into 1 week. And so we've been working with a college over the last 3 years to provide a kind of an online self-paced college accredited course where our pilot candidates can take that over a term, 8 weeks, again, self-paced online, so that we can provide an opportunity to take a deeper dive in those really, really important knowledge topics. And because we're able to do that, and I'm grateful and thankful that we have a bureau and an organization and an aviation culture in the Bureau and the National Aviation Office that allows us to do that, we get to spend that much more time in person. So at the conclusion of that 8 week online, we come together for 2 weeks. And again, because we've carved out so much time for folks to focus on the knowledge, we can really focus on the performance. And so for the BLM, at the conclusion of that online piece, we come together for 2 weeks of in-person training. The first week is the A450, so we check the department box, and we just learn basic flight maneuvering and inputs. And then the second week is a little bit more application-based, basic mapping, basic cinematography, you know, basic applications, so that, you know, the overall goal is when we send our remote pilots home, they're set up for success.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, and that's just foundational, yeah. Right? So if we get into the wildland fire side of things, then we have another week of class called S373, Incident Operations with UAS. And that's how that's really focused on communication, coordination, deconfliction in an airspace where fixed wing and rotorcraft are operating. Right. And so how do we integrate into that airspace, into an FTR or a TFR, FTA safely, so that everybody in that airspace can do the job, which of course the goal is to support, you know, the folks on the ground doing the work. So that's another week, right? And then there's the aerial ignition component, which is a three-week academy, 1 week in class, you know, learning the payload, and then 2 week practicum, traveling around the southwest and or southeast and the west, dropping balls, just, you know, so we can really put a lot of energy and speed to competency and get folks out doing good work.
Yeah, that's a lot of you would need a lot of training for that too.
Yeah.
I was thinking, so what university are you working with then?
We're actually working with the community college out of the Dalles, Oregon, Columbia Gorge Community College. And we're about 3 years into that relationship and just really trying to, you know, build something that will serve our purposes and needs, but also give them something that, you know, that they can use in their kind of in their region, their, you know, the city, county, state, private landowners that might want to use UAS to do whatever they want to do, right? That there's this kind of standardized access to some standardized training and education that really doesn't exist today. You know, the FAA is the Part 107, and it's just a knowledge test with no performance practicum, right?
Right, so like for specifically what we use UAS for.
Right, yeah. So that's the college that we're partnered with, and we're at, again, you know, 3 years into this relationship, and now we're at that point where we're collaborating with colleges and universities. So we're collaborating with Clemson, collaborate with Oklahoma State University, and there are others. And the gentleman we work with over there is the director of their UAS program and the professor. And of course, that's his network. The academic network is his network. So kind of lean on him to bring in the right folks and the right partners. But just trying to grow this. And at the end of the day, this UAS endeavor is absolutely pioneering. So it's lacking a lot of policy rules and regulations. It's lacking, you know, curriculum standards and training standards. And I think that's a credit. I think the department and OAS and the BLM and the folks in this wildland fire interagency community should be proud of is where there is an absence of those things. We've really kind of led the way in the last 7 years on developing what we've developed, at least on the incident front.
And is there like required firefighting training? I mean, should you have fire experience before getting training in UAS?
Well, I think because of what I just said, you know, it's pioneering. So that's a philosophical question, yeah. Right? Like, do you have to have XYZ, you know, 5 years of firefighting experience or, you know, a certain amount of quals to do this? And so I can't give you a clear answer. I land on the philosophical side of, you know, right now this is absolutely for the BLM, it's an aviation endeavor. So I put all of our emphasis on being a pilot operating aircraft in the national airspace. And so my philosophical answer to that question is no. I just need you to have your basic, you know, 130, 190, whatever pack test we need you to have.
And to be able to be red carded.
To be red carded, right? And then we're going to train you to be a pilot. We're going to train you to do good things on the fire line and provide that training experience to make you functional, safe, efficient, all those things.
So is this training offered every year or how often come about?
Well, for the BLM, we've been in the department, by and large, we've been shut down for, you know, 5 years because of various policies. And although those policies got rescinded in some way or another, in one way or another in 2022, we were in such a state and didn't have access to, you know, compliant aircraft per policy that we've remained stale and stagnant as a program. And this is like year five since the shutdown in 2020. So our training offerings have been limited to non-existent for the Bureau at large. But on the wildland fire side, because of the exemptions or exceptions we were given during that shutdown, that training community and delivery schedule has remained pretty robust. The Forest Service programs grew during that time period. And so I think, you know, on average, I've got a mental schedule in my head here where I think the interagency community delivers, you know, 5 or 6 iterations of that A450 S373 every year, by and large for Forest Service, Park Service, BIA, Fish and Wildlife Service and ourselves, and state partners when and where we can get them in.
And then, so once you become a pilot and all that, do you do a refresher training then after that? Or refresher every year, or how does that?
Yeah, the four qualifications that exist in the 310-1 are UASP, which is the pilot. There's a UAS manager, which we use to kind of manage the large call when needed type 1, type 2 UAS, the big, think big, you know, like military looking drones. Right. We have a UAS data specialist, which kind of takes the data that we collect and processes it into usable products and material, and then a UASL, which is a leader, which is kind of undefined at the moment in some ways, but it effectively is a UAS pilot with a single resource boss qualification, so we can provide that fireline supervision to folks that may not have fire experience or qualifications, but have the ability to be a pilot. So those are four 310-1 qualifications, and they have refresher requirements. And so there are, via, you know, RT-373 annual requirements to stay proficient and current on the wildland fire side. But there's also OAS and DOI pilot proficiency and currency requirements to maintain your DOI card. So those are there. We live in this world where we straddle a fence, where we have these kind of aviation cards and qualifications and requirements, and also a fire line. And that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot to manage and a lot to maintain.
And how many remote pilots do we have currently?
The BLM, we're at our peak, we're at 187. But again, over the last 5 years, we've regressed a little bit. I think we're sitting around 70. And I think this time next year, we'll likely be around 130 as we start to reintegrate our pilots into new aircraft. And then the outlook is, you know, it's sizable. The Bureau wants to do this and use this. And it's just a matter of, you know, finding the time to develop the training, provide the training, and get folks carted on aircraft.
Right. Well, the application for the use of UAS on wildfires is tremendous as far as being able to, for situational awareness, for our crews on the ground. You can put up a unmanned, uncrewed aircraft, yeah. And instead of maybe a helicopter that could be dropping buckets somewhere, and yeah. You can actually go and check out the line and or mapping and,
yep.
And like you said, prescribed fire or even backburning or...
All the above.
All that stuff.
Yeah, I think the thing about, you know, what we're doing, I mean, I was around when we couldn't buy our way onto the fire line. You know, drones were a four-letter word, and, you know, it's like, no, we don't want that on our division. But now, I mean, it's just the demand is through the roof. The demand far out exceeds our capacity to staff and meet the need. So, but the things that we are doing are what you just mentioned, right? Situational awareness. We can, you know, the traditional way we look for hotspots is to get into 10 or 20 person line, right? And we're going to grid, use the back of our hand, heads down, and, you know, all these overhead hazards and all that. And it maybe takes us an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours to push a crew through a division gridding. We can put a drone up, literally, you know, fly that section of line and back in a battery cycle, so 20 minutes, and it'll tell you if you have anything, right? So
they have an infrared kind of.
Yeah, it's got a thermal camera, right? Yeah. So it allows, that provides two things. It's an efficiency thing, right? It's a safety thing because we're not putting people,
right?
But it's also like a shift or a tour or a career extender, right? Like, because now you can just kind of hang tight until we find something and can tell you exactly where it's at. And we're saving all of that kind of energy and exposure, you know. And you mentioned aerial ignition. It's in high demand. It's super effective and efficient. We can fly daytime, nighttime in smoky conditions. It's very effective. As we look out the window today and see it's very smoky, and a lot of aircraft, traditional aircraft, maybe aren't flying, but our drones can. And I think the exciting thing is are the things that we're not doing yet, right? The things that we haven't developed, you know, long line logistics support. I often comment and think, you know, I would love to take somebody's IA pack from 45 pounds down to 10 pounds. How could we do that? How could we support that crew logistically?
You have a little drone flying behind.
Yeah, right. I mean, if we, or even here, just somebody having to haul a jerry can down a canyon and up the other side during a burnout operation, you know, if I can sling that over, just how many times do you do that in a career? And you know, how much time does that take? And, you know, again, back to exposure and risk and just leveraging the technology to be a better workforce for, you know, what's coming at us in the next quarter century is super exciting. And this program is just right at the tip of that spear.
Yeah, that is exciting. And, well, you hear about drone delivery for packages at your doorsteps and things like that, too. So, yeah, why not on the fire line?
Why not? Why not?
That'd be great. Yeah. Here, just take my pack so while I out of here.
Yeah. We need a QB, whatever, right? Yeah. So just trying to define those things that are important to the community and then develop solutions.
So what do you see as challenging for the program or most challenging about your job?
Education. You know, I think just sharing what it is and what it means to have an aviation program like this. So if we're going to have a 250-ish remote pilot bureau and a 250-ish remote systems aircraft bureau. So that's like an Air Force. That's a 3,000% increase in our existing aviation footprint that requires a lot of management and leadership. A lot.
Right?
Yeah. So that's a challenge, is trying to communicate that and educate folks, because everybody in the Bureau, top to bottom, bottom to top, wants to make good decisions and make the best use of a BLM dollar for the Bureau mission and what we're doing out there on behalf of the public. And so that's a challenge, right? That's like, here's this new technology, here's this new thing, you know, seemingly I can buy it off the shelf and go fly it. What's the big deal? But we're the government. You know, we can buy iPhones off the shelf. We can buy things, like lots of things off the shelf, but we still want to make sure that people are set up for success and are able to use it safely and efficiently. So as I mentioned earlier, there is no training by and large beyond this kind of basic. And so we need to develop that, and we need staff to maintain that, and we need staff to deliver that. And then we have aircraft inspections and pilot refreshers and all of these things. You know, UAS and the Bureau is going to be in a constant state, and really for the DOI and interagency community, is a constant state of what I call RDTTE, research, development, training, testing, and evaluation.
Well, I'm sure the technology is constantly changing.
Changing. Yeah. So it takes staff to manage that too. So I'm really excited about, and it's a challenge, but probably the most exciting part of the job is that challenge, right? It's an opportunity to... And this has probably been the highlight of my time in this position, is that it's been, this program and this technology has been like a convener of bureau directorates and programs. Like, it's brought us together in a way that I had never experienced before. So, because it's one aviation program for the Bureau. So we all have to kind of work together. You know, fire is just a program area we serve, right? Just like archaeology or law enforcement. And so it's brought everybody together. And that's, you know, challenge, opportunity. The BLM is, I think, situated in a way because of kind of our size and our aviation culture in the Bureau. The leadership that exists, you know, with Grant Beebe and his peer group and higher, that they recognize and respect and appreciate that, hey, you know, a 3,000% increase in aviation, 3,000% increase in pilots and aircraft that we have to manage, you know, think hangar. Like, what does it take to manage a hangar? And that's going to be tough to do with the status quo. So, you know, dear BLM, what do we want to do? Right. And so that's exciting. And it's taken some years to kind of communicate that message. And I do feel like we're at a place now where we're all kind of reading the same sheet of music. And it's just a matter of really, I think, determining, you know, what we want to do with this technology and this program moving forward. And then, you know, how do we set ourselves up as a program for success and a Bureau for success as we look at this next 25 years?
So what do you see as the next 25 years?
Well, you know, if I think we have a real opportunity to address some of the things that are important in our organization today. You know, we talk a lot about mental health and work-life balance and
Retention of firefighters. Yeah,
recruitment, retention, all of those things are, you know, collateral duty, the strain of collateral duty. Those are all factors that I think UAS can help, not UAS, you know, the physical aircraft and remote pilots, but it's an opportunity for us to, you know, kind of look at how we structure our organization, you know, in this pioneering technology and what we want to do to address a 3,000% increase. There's an opportunity there to kind of, you know, staff a program and right size it and have it mission focused in a field that is attractive to a lot of people that want to come do that. And, you know, if I think about workforce development, I'm thinking about the eighth graders today. You know, I've got three kids. I'm thinking about my seventh grader, my 10th grader, and my 12th grader. What type of a workplace do they want to move into and what do they want to do? That's where my focus is at. So if I look at the next 25 years, the most important thing for us to do as a Bureau in the next 5 years is provide a very, very, very strong foundation for this program and this Bureau to grow upon moving forward. In 25 years, looking back, I don't want, you know, people that are working in that era to look back and say, man, I wish those guys back in 2024 and 2025 would have pulled their heads out of their, you know what, like right. We have enough organizational history and lessons and aviation lessons of the last 20, 30, and 40 years to inform what right looks like moving forward. And we don't need something bad to happen to do that. We just need to, you know, reflect on our history and our lessons and be a student of humans and be a student of organizations and really lean into these things that we say are important and set this Bureau up for the next 25 years.
That's good advice for any program area that we're trying to grow. And
100%.
But I think of, you know, just the issues with recruitment right now and, you know, is there a shift in what people want to do? And, you know, there's maybe a lot of people out there don't want to be firefighters on the line, that physical labor. And there's a lot of people that do. I loved it when I was out doing IA and you're out getting to see cool places, but you could do that and be a techie person and not have to be like a firefighter per se, but you could go to cool places. And,
Yeah, there'll be no shortage of work, that's for sure. So it is a matter of...
It's just getting the program support and building that
program. Yeah, and then identifying, program. You know, the folks that want to do it and recruiting them. And I think that's one of the things that I do pay attention to is aligning, right? Aligning the talent with the mission and a lifestyle that people want to live. And I think one of the challenges of looking at fires, you know, I don't have any direct experience. I just kind of keep my ears open around campus, right? Or at the training center and... That, you know, a lot of folks want it all, right? I want a family life and I want to go on fires and have that adventure, but I don't want to be gone all the time. Like, so how do we structure, right? And I think, again, it's just a matter of identifying those missions, that mission, program mission, and staffing to account for what the job and the priorities are.
Absolutely. I think you kind of answered this through that last question a little bit, but how has the usage of UAS improved the ability to fight fire in general?
Well, I can't say that I've coined this. It might have been Kelly Boyd, but Kelly Boyd is the UAS aerial ignition specialist for the Forest Service, which is to say He is the UAS Air Ignition Specialist for the Interagency Fire Community. And his quote is, "We've taken back the night." You know, for probably when you and I started, we did a lot of firefighting at night. And then it seemed like there was an era where we didn't do so much because of the risk with snags and rocks, all the inherent hazards that exist at night on the fire line. And UAS, we're back. Like, it's night. I mean, it is a nighttime swing shift, smoky condition tool that just excels. And so I see that aspect of it, whether it's just situational awareness or dropping balls, as absolute game changer, being that deep lighter for a hand ignition operation.
Which is like you said, dropping balls.
Yeah, dropping the balls, right?
Ignition.
Being able to, you know, put a drone up on a ridgeline and walk the fire line down with their ignition in a very, I mean, just precise. And it keeps the intensities and severity down and holding more manageable. Like, so that's a game changer. I think one of the most fun things that I've got to do is, you know, you're out there at 0500 and you're flying the fire line for that division. And we'll have the TV set up much like that TV right there. And we'll cast what we're seeing of that TV. And so everybody, the division and all of the, and ops and all of the, you know, the hotshot soups are gaggled up and they're getting a look at their line without having to get in a helicopter or
get the IR flight that they might not get from the night before.
Absolutely.
To get that.
And they're getting it all. And we take a video and then we pull the card, we scrub it down into like a 1 or 2 minute 4K video. They airdrop it to all of their people so everybody can see it, right? And I just think that that's a cool, like everybody comes together, you share the intel, they go out and do their work, they come back and, hey, can you go take a look at this again? And it seems very, very simple, but it's just so efficient and useful, right? And I really appreciate that. I think another way it's changed it is unfortunate circumstances like investigations and things like that. You know, that's become, UAS has become a real tool that you want to have in your back pocket for those situations. And we've had to do that a couple of times. And again, as tragic as those situations are, providing documentation and footage and to give us that understanding of what happened and why. And, you know, we're a learning community and we want to learn what happened. And UAS is serving that side of the firehouse as well.
And yeah, and just not for accident investigations, but also for fire investigation.
Right.
I know a couple of fire investigators that are carded UAS pilots.
Yep.
And use that to get that aerial view. And I know when I did fire investigation, a lot of times you're out there and you've got a large area to cover. And it,
yeah,
boy, would be nice to, yeah, see this from the air, to see what the burn patterns look like from,
yeah,
the air. And that's another opportunity to do that.
For sure.
Or for surveillance, for people out who's out there,
yeah,
watching.
Yeah. Well, that's like a 4-letter word too. I think that was like in the early years, it was like, I think that's why people were against the drone program, right?
Because
it's like,
you're spying,
you're watching,
yeah,
you. And it's like, well, fair enough.
Yeah.
But we're beyond that. I think it's become such a thing globally that it's...
Well, and it's kind of, well, and everyone has cell phones now too, right? With videos, people are watching people everywhere.
Yeah, know? Yep, exactly.
And then with firefighters, we have the location-based services too. And that was kind of contentious a little bit at the same time. You're
yeah,
just watching where we're going all the time, Big Brother. And,
yep,
but it's actually, you know, for their safety and,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. I can't speak for the law enforcement mission. I think that's a program that we're really looking forward to helping evolve in the BLM, but by and large, that surveillance or people,
right,
watching mission isn't that prevalent on the wildland fire side. You know, it's really, like I said, just situational awareness and,
right, use for tactics.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
And SA for firefighters. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think about, yeah, for, well, and the other applications would be nice. We have a lot of areas to cover and some of these fires that are getting so big,
yeah,
that you can't possibly cover them.
Yeah.
On foot sometimes.
Yeah. And that speaks to, in some ways, that speaks to the evolution of the program. You know, when we started in 2015 and 16, we were flying this aircraft called the 3DR Solo. On a good day, it had like 6 to 9 minutes of battery life. You maybe could get it, you know, half mile, a mile away from where you launched. It crashed 50% of the time. You never took your eyes off of it. And so that was the kind of extent of the technology in 2016. Now today, we're flying aircraft that are going out 3, 4, 5 miles, 20, 30 minutes of battery life, and you never have your eyes on it. because it's around the corner and it's in the smoke, and that's a whole different training qualification. But the point is, well, what's next? And how does that shape and shift the training standards and requirements? If I can operate an aircraft that's going to be in the air for an hour and 5 or 10 miles from home, that's a little bit different than the basic required training operating an aircraft that is only up for 10 minutes and never further than a mile from home.
Right.
So that gets back to that, you know, the earlier topics and conversations and points about staffing and the program. Like, there's the now, but tomorrow's tomorrow and it's coming. Or, you know, are we postured to embrace it when it comes? Or are we going to be like, man, we're not ready for this?
Well, I can see, you know, firefighters as well as yourself being a hotshot. Maybe it's kind of nice to not have to be on the fire line and do that after a while and and have this to go to.
Yeah.
Just like a lot of them will go do other types of jobs, to other type of support jobs, but this add this to the list.
Yeah, I think this is a really nice compliment to the Bureau.
Yeah, so if someone was interested in becoming a remote pilot or interested in the program, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, so right now everybody is operating in a collateral duty, just like any other fire qualification by and large, right? So it's working through state aviation managers, unit aviation managers to kind of express, and that's the same, right? So again, I mentioned earlier, this is a Bureau program. Fire is a program area we serve. So it's the same message for the archaeologist, the wildlife biologist, law enforcement, fire staff that want to pursue this, is work, you know, start that conversation with unit aviation manager and state aviation manager. And we have some supplements and some forms and some things that the state aviation managers are well versed in that help communicate what that looks like from a training standpoint, a cost standpoint, commitment standpoint, because of all the proficiency and currency requirements. And so that's the first stop. Start the conversation. And I think we're at the point now where it's like, you know, that's the individual perspective, but how does that fit into a district or a state or a national program or center's overall strategy for UAS utilization and you know, what makes the most sense? But we collect those, you know, once a year, and that informs what we're going to order, how much we're going to order, where it's going. And then that informs a training plan and then a training schedule. And then we deliver that training and send people on their way.
So it'd be like any other type of qualification then, if you want to pursue something different, maybe.
Yeah. It's sexy, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of commitment.
Well, you have to get your pilot's license from the FAA first, right?
Yep. And then, the 107.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the first step.
Awesome. So in the last episode, we talked with the Helitech crew members about problems with drone incursions, and those are aircrafts that enter airspace, enter our wildfires that are not welcome because we don't know they're there and they can shut down operations, especially aviation operations. Can you explain the difference between using like a certified UAS to those that fly into temporary restricted airspace?
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, you're well versed on If You Fly, We Can't, that campaign that is meant to reach, you know, probably the public or the recreational drone operators. And again, I mean, it's like, yeah, you've got an aircraft with a 4K camera and you've got this fire out your backyard.
Right.
I mean, who wouldn't want the footage? And it's tempting. And of course, that's why that campaign is so important, that, you know, if you are flying, we can't, because you just can't see those drones in the airspace. And we've even, for lack of a better word, I mean, we tried to like sticker or put lights on our aircraft so they're easier to see. Oh. And it's still, they're impossible to see. Like,
especially if it's smoky or something.
Yeah, you just can't see it. You know, for the helicopter pilots and the fixed wing pilots coming in, they just can't see it. So of course, that's why that's important to have that campaign. On our side, on the trained and certified side, qualified side, that's the very thing that we're trained to do, right? So it's, you know, when you go to S373 to become a UASP trainee and then task book and all of that stuff, it's not about operating the aircraft. It's about comm scripts and working with air attack and coordinating and deconflicting airspace and talking to helibase and all of the people that have a stake in the safety of that airspace. And in that regard, the UAS are just like a retardant plane or a helicopter with a bucket. Like, you're in the stack. You've got to communicate, and you are the lowest priority. UAS is the lowest priority because we can see in a void. They can't, you know, everybody else can't see in a void. And that is a training and a class and a qualification. And we, the IFUAS committee under NIAC and the folks that are stewards of that qualification and those trainings take a lot of pride in the status of that qualification and the operations there. And so that's the overall difference, is really just how we communicate, coordinate, deconflict with air attack and other aviation assets so that we don't have a mishap. And if we don't have those things in place, we don't leave the ground. It's only when we have approval to do a mission at the request of division and ops and we get approval from air attack that we do that. And even still, it requires a lot of communication and coordination. And what's different about UAS, of course, is that we're on the ground with FM radios and everybody in the stack is on their AM Victor and they're having to communicate. They're able to communicate. We can listen on AM, but we don't communicate on AM. So that's unique. And I give a lot of credit to the air attack community, aerial supervision community, AOBDs, the helibase, helitac folks, that the helicopter folks that see that for what it is and have really made an effort to, you know, roll us into that airspace operation over the last 7 or 8 years and really ensure that the pride, that's a proud group, the people that operate in that stack. And we're just thankful and grateful that we've been able to work with them and develop that training and have integrated pretty dang successfully, in my opinion.
So you're working a lot with the like air attack. So they're up there, and how would that work with the using a UAS? Because they're kind of the eyes in the sky already for the fire.
Yeah.
How would the UAS benefit that operation?
Benefit what?
I guess benefit what they're seeing or what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I think, and I've never been in air attack, so it's a little bit of speculation on my part, but they're, you know, they're the aerial supervision. It's airspace safety is their number one thing. And then, you know, not doing division's job is the other job, right? Like, you know, they can provide some communication on what they're observing, but at the end of the day, they're in orbit and it's smoky. They got a lot
I was going to say that, and they're higher in the air.
Higher in the air, and they got a lot going on. I mean, I can only imagine what's going on in, you know, over in Region 6 right now. There's a lot going on. And it's constant communication, radio chatter, AM and FM, right? People on the ground want to talk to them. People in the air want to talk to them. Right. They're providing the clearance into the airspace. And so what can UAS provide? Well, they, you know, from a division standpoint, which is about all we can really do. We can't do a whole fire stuff. We can spread people around the fire on various divisions. But that, it's back to what we talked about. It's situational awareness. What are you seeing? What's over that hill? We want to do this. Does this make sense? Well, let's have a look. And we just pop it up after we've been given clearance from air attack. You know, we've got a request from division to fly this line, see if we've got any spots in the green, or we want to see around the corner and see if their plan's going to work. And we request that from that clearance from air attack. Air attack gives it, and we follow protocol and do the mission.
Great.
Yeah.
No, I know you mentioned that we can't fly if you do, basically, entering our airspace. Mm-hmm. But there's a really good website. The FAA has the Know Before You Fly site, mm-hmm. too. And it just have a wildfire component. So for people to understand what's going on the fire and why they shouldn't be going out there,
it would be
a good site for people to look at and just know before they fly.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think it's a really important campaign that you guys are leading. And
yeah, even with that, we still have a lot of drone incursions happening.
Yeah, so. But less.
Yeah,
less. I think it's less. Yeah. I mean, I just paying attention to the early years, and I think there'll be some changes coming just from an FAA standpoint, but education seems to be working, in my opinion. Yeah, we have incursions for sure, but it's kind of like the Smokey the Bear campaign. It takes some time, right? Like, right. It's a message. And
it evolves, too.
And I think, I mean, that brings up a good point. You know, we talk about the next 25 years. We talked about the workforce. You focused on eighth graders and, you know, that education campaign, you know, is probably better geared to fourth, fifth, sixth graders and not the adults, right? Because that's really right. The folks that are, A, have an interest in UAS, or B, may enter our workforce at some point, but it's the kids that are going to be like, hey, Dad, you shouldn't be flying that drone, right? Like, it just...
Well, like with Smokey Bear, hey, we should be putting this campfire out, stirring it.
That's right, yeah. So that's something I'd like to see in the next handful of years is a little bit more... just broad engagement with the youth to cultivate a little bit of passion for aviation in UAS to, you know, posture our BRO up for success with future recruitment, right? But also the education piece, right? You know, understand the tech for sure, but those things like if you fly, we can't, that's an important message and we probably can't say it enough. and deliver it enough. So that's something that I've got my eye on, is if we've got the room or capacity to invest a little bit more in that.
Yeah, and we can help you out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Help deliver that message any way we can.
Yeah, that'd be great.
For sure. So is there anything else you want to talk about that we maybe haven't covered?
You know, I think just broadly, you know, what's the real-time status of the program and you know, where are we at, where are we headed? And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're coming out of a five-year hiatus. We're retiring our existing fleet. We're transitioning to new compliant aircraft. Operative word there being transitioning. So we're in a transition period, right? So we're entering kind of our third distinct era of the BLM program. And that's going to take some time, right? So of those 70 remote pilots that are out there carded and current in the Bureau, we have to get them new aircraft and get them trained on that aircraft.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was going to ask, is what type of aircraft, and then if you switch aircraft, there's different...
Another training.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's not unlike, you know, normal aviation, right? If you're trained to fly on a Cessna or whatever, and you're moving into a King Air, there's a training, right? So this transition period is going to take us a year or two for a variety of reasons, but so it's just, you know, communicating and you know, encouraging and imploring all of our stakeholders and program areas and directorates to be patient with us as we try our hardest and try our best, and we do. Myself, Bobby Isley, and the NAO are pretty passionate about this, but we're also passionate about doing it right, and we're passionate about not biting off more than we can chew as a program, being able to manage and sustain what we've got. So that transition period, like I said, it'll take a year or two to get folks, existing folks, moved into new aircraft and get the rest of the program areas in the Bureau back up and running. To answer your question of what aircraft are we moving to, right now we're moving to three different aircraft. The BLM, by and large, is because of the advancements in technology with UAS. In the fire world, we've categorized them into four types. Type 1, Type 2 are the big, call when needed. We don't own any of those. We contract that for fire when and where we need it. And then Type 3 and Type 4. Type 3 is the aircraft. It's larger, heavy lift. That's our aerial ignition platform. And then Type 4 is all the smalls underneath that. And by and large, the Bureau can subsist on Type 4 UAS. And so we're looking at the Skydio OX-10 as our DOI partners and the Freefly Astro as our DOI partners. And we're really excited about it. We've really been waiting for, you know, 2 years for a reliable aircraft to make its way to the market, and we're there. And so we've been flying and testing the Skydio OX-10. Bobby and I are taking the Astro out next week to Montana for a project to give it, to put it through its paces. Our Alaska UAS folks just came down and we mobilized them to a fire in California yesterday, and they're going to fly the Skydio OX-10 and put it through its paces. And then the Forest Service has been flying the Freefly Alta X, which is that heavy lift that we're the DOI is transitioning to. The Forest Service has been flying it for 3 years. And so it's been through its paces.
Is it like the type one of?
Type three.
Or type, okay.
Yep, so type three. I mean, that's the heavy lift aircraft for us. So type three and type four are agency owned, operated, and then type one and type two, because of cost and sophisticated nature in which they fly, or contracted.
Got it.
Yep.
They're kind of like the VLATs of the air tanker world, large air tanker compared to.
And that's its own program, and it has its own growing pains to go through. You know, none of these systems, none of them were made to operate in the wildland fire environment. So smoke, dirt, turbulence, all of those things, it's just back to what I said, it's a constant evolution and modification, learning, and it's really pioneering days. Of course, that's pioneering days are exciting.
Yeah,
so absolutely. It's never a dull moment.
How long can a typical aircraft then fly for?
So the larger hours. Yeah, the larger type one and type two have long endurance and loitering times, hours, and greater range, in excess of 5, 10, 15 miles. Our type three and type four are 20 to 30 minutes of endurance, and then in that kind of 2 to 5 mile range.
But you can get a lot done in that.
You can get a lot done.
Yeah.
You can get a lot done. Yep.
And is there restrictions like on wind and that kind of thing?
Yeah. Every manufacturer comes with their specs. Yeah. I mean, 20, 25 mile an hour sustained is kind of the threshold. It eats a lot of battery. And, you know, if you're looking for quality imagery, you're probably not going to get it when it's windy.
because it's moving around.
Yeah. But if you're just, you know, quick periscope up, or, you know, maybe just a quick lap for some SA, we fly in 20 pretty regularly.
Awesome. I've learned a lot today about you.
Oh, I'm so happy.
The remote pilots and remote systems program, UAS.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if you really wanted to dive into the systems and what they can do, you know, whether it's a future episode or whatever, part two of this, I would really encourage you to connect with Bobby Isley in our shop. And just, he's just so brilliant. You know, he just knows so much about these systems and what they can and can't do. And there's an education component to that, to our kind of our constituency is people want it. They want to do this thing. And it's like, well, you want to do this thing, but that doesn't exist yet. Or we haven't figured out the integration yet because none of it's built for what we do. And well, how long is it going to take to integrate? Years, right? Months. I don't know. We don't know, right? The parts or pieces. And anyways, it's an invitation and encouragement to you. If you wanted a part two, I mean, in just talk systems and what it takes for Bobby to be the fleet manager for the Bureau, and it would be entertaining.
I'm sure it would. Yeah. And to manage, the fleet, you have to make sure they're all operational and know all the pieces and parts of all those aircraft. So,
He's kind of like, he's got his own little laboratory over there next to the hangar, and there's always aircraft in various states of repair and various states of, you know, procurement and delivery and all that. So, yeah, encourage anybody that wants to see that to stop by and see him and see that or see us and ask questions. But we're excited for this next era.
All right. And if people are interested, they get a hold of their aviation folks.
Yep.
Talk UAS and... Yeah. Got to be serious about it because it's a commitment.
It's a commitment, yep. And right now it's a collateral duty commitment.
Yeah, like most everything like that most we everything do. Else, yep. Yeah, but that's also what makes our jobs kind of fun because we get to step aside and do other things.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think
interesting.
The collateral duty piece is, at least on the UAS side, I'll just speak to UAS, of course, is the second and third and fourth order effects of the collateral duty. Yeah, it's one thing to say that this is an addition to your day job, but for the UAS program to exist, it's collateral duty training development, right? Curriculum development, training maintenance, curriculum maintenance, training delivery. All so there's that person or those people that are collateral duty pilots
are also
to their day job. They're also
helping train.
Right. And so there's three or four or five orders of effect there. And that's what we're really trying to resolve in the BLM is, again, recruitment, retention. Well, let's look at the factors that are challenging us. Let's look at the factors of increasing the Bureau aviation footprint by 3,000%. Let's look at these factors and try to resolve them for the betterment of the Bureau, for the betterment of employee experience, for the betterment of being a place that people want to work. Mm-hmm. It's right there.
Yeah, because it's not just for fire. I mean, there's a lot of a lot of uses for UAS and just land management.
That's right. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Matt, for joining me today and for the 29th episode of Wildfire Matters to tell us more about the use of UAS on wildfires and why you went to Remote Pilots Remote Systems program.
You got it.
And it makes sense. It's not as like easy to say, though, as UAS.
I know. I know.
RM.
Believe me, I know.
The acronym doesn't work.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out a way to make it just roll off the tongue, but we're not there yet.
It's just remote.
Yeah.
You're doing remote stuff with aviation. For those of you listening, thank you. And if you have questions or comments or even suggestions on different topics of our podcast, please email them to blm_fa_nifc_comments@blm.gov. And use Wildfire Matters Podcast in the subject line. To learn more about NIFC or the BLM, please visit our website, www.nifc.gov, and follow us at BLM Fire on Facebook, X, formerly Twitter, and Instagram. And join us next time when I hope to spark a conversation with a member of Dispatch. They play a vital role, support role, just as UAS, in our wildland fire management. And I know they're kind of strapped right now with all the activity going on, and looks like things aren't going to get any better for us in the next month or so. So it might be a while before we're back, but hopefully we'll get somebody from Dispatch to tell us about the critical role they play in managing or helping us manage wildfires. And until then, stay safe and be wildfire aware.